Iranian foreign minister rejects Western media reports about an alleged crackdown on peaceful protests in his country, saying only murderers and terrorists were arrested. The Ukrainian military says fighting is going on in Bakhmut around the clock, while Russian forces trying to encircle the town from three directions. Plus, South Korea and the US plan to carry out large-scale military drills this month as tensions remain high with the North. Our top story this hour, Iran's foreign minister has rejected Western media allegations of a crackdown on peaceful protests that hit the country a few months ago. Hossein Amir Abdullahian says no one was arrested during the peaceful rallies. In a tweet, Iran's top diplomat said arrests were made only when the protests took a turn towards rioting, chaos and violence. Even then, Amir Abdullahian added, only foreign and terrorist elements and troublemakers were arrested. He said the general amnesty that was declared later by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, covered all the arrestees. The decree excluded those who had killed people and terrorists. It was declared on the occasion of the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Iran has strongly condemned Israel's threat to use military force against its non-military and vital infrastructure as a blatant violation of international humanitarian law. Iran's permanent ambassador to the United Nations said such a move would also contravene the Charter of the United Nations. Amir Saeed Erevani added that any Israeli military attack on Iran's infrastructural facilities would have devastating effects on regional and international peace and security. He urged the Security Council to fulfill its responsibility in this regard and condemned the Israeli regime's warmongering remarks as a real threat to international peace and security. Erevani emphasized that Iran reserves the right to give a crushing response to any wrong step taken by the Zionist regime at any place and any time. He noted that anybody supporting Israel's military action against Iran would also be held to account. Lebanon is working to prepare the ground for drilling operations in gas fields off its coast. Our correspondent Mariam Saleh has more from Lebanon.
With a crippling economy and a local currency losing more than 90% of its value, many of the Lebanese people dealing with economic hardships are hoping that the upcoming drilling activity in Lebanon's waters will lead to the extraction of gas. We are here on the Lebanese southern coast facing Block 9, which includes the Qana field, prospective gas-rich field where Total Energies is expected to begin drilling this summer. And although it might be a while until the country sees any tangible revenues, many believe it could be the only life buoy for a drowning economy. According to the schedule, the program will continue for over a year, and that they're now waiting for the arrival of a rig that's needed for the drilling operation.
We are very serious about the need to drill as soon as possible and find out if indeed all the hopes and the positive assessments that we heard from and opinions that we heard from the CEOs of Eni and of Total, that indeed we have a promising field in Qana and that we will indeed have a discovery toward the end of the year. That's our hope.
As officials are working out the logistics for the foreign companies, observers remain worried over a potential intervention by the United States, which has placed many sanctions impacting Lebanon in recent years.
It's about time for the Americans to stop hindering the companies, and also it's about time for the Lebanese government in order to stand still and insist on Lebanese extraction of the oil and the gas.
This place could have been a confrontation ground. Instead, it is witnessing unprecedented tranquility. The 64-year-old Jamal Hamzi is a retired school principal who now spends most of his time in his garden. Like many in the southern border town of Naqoura, he believes that this is all due to the fact that the resistance has deterred the Israeli regime from threatening the area.
Lebanon should be able to drill its gas resources before Israel can start drilling operation in the Karish field. That was the equation that Sayed Hassan Nasrallah raised, and if it weren't for this equation, then we could not talk about drilling in Block 9 or achieve the victories we have had.
The resistance is the only hope we have to be able to restore our rights to our oil and gas resources. We were able to get the maritime deal thanks to the power of the resistance.
Total Energies has stressed that the maritime deal between Lebanon and the Israeli regime ended a deadlock over exploration activities. But some in Lebanon believe Hezbollah might need another round of UAV operations to get the drilling operation on track. Maryam Saleh, Naqoura, South Lebanon.
Ukrainian forces are struggling to hang on to their positions in Bakhmut, an eastern town that has been the site of the longest and bloodiest battle since the Russia-Ukraine war broke out. The battle for Bakhmut is raging around the clock, that's according to a senior Ukrainian military official. He says the situation is critical and that Kiev needs to get its hands on more ammunition as soon as possible. Ukrainian forces are said to have repelled dozens of Russian attacks in the past 24 hours. The Russians are trying to encircle Bakhmut from the north, east and south. Capturing the town would enable them to seize the rest of the strategic Donbass region. In the meantime, the Ukrainian military has reported the Russian missile attacks in central Zaporizhia region and the southern Kherson region. Our correspondent in Moscow, Johnny Miller, tells us more about the fierce fighting in the Ukrainian town of Bakhmut.
Well, it looks like it's just a matter of time until Ukraine withdraws from Bakhmut. Officially, Ukraine is still saying that they are defending the city, but on the social networks, from more private conversations, it looks very much like it's just a matter of time before Bakhmut falls to Russia. Lots of footage of Ukrainian soldiers trying to get out of Bakhmut, leaving before they are encircled. It's not clear whether Russia is able to completely surround the town, whether there'll be Ukrainian soldiers stuck in that encirclement, or whether they'll be able to get out. But the process of taking Bakhmut still may take some time. Ukraine heavily mines areas they're defending, particularly the retreat from, so it'll take a long time to clear those mines. So it looks like Bakhmut will fall to Russia, but then we expect Ukraine to move back to more defensive lines. Still some major settlements in the Donbass to take. So the war for Donbass still far from over. But Russia at the moment very much focusing, instead of necessarily capturing territory, it's focusing on destroying the Ukrainian army as much as possible. And that for that reason, Bakhmut has been a success for Russia, as Ukraine has sent constant streams of reinforcements into Bakhmut, and the casualties on the Ukrainian side in Bakhmut have been huge.
Hundreds of thousands of teachers in the United Kingdom are on a three-day strike to demand higher pay and more funding for schools. This has forced millions of kids to stay at home. The government says higher pay rises would worsen the country's inflation that's now at more than 10%. Saeed Pereza reports from a teachers' rally in northwest London.
It's Walkout Thursday in Britain as tens of thousands of teachers walk off the job once again. Sapna has been a teacher for 11 years.
Now it just feels like we've got to carry on with the strikes because they're not listening to us, they're not valuing us, and they're not giving us what we want, better conditions, better pay, and all of that really.
This is day three of a nationwide strike that has forced thousands of schools closed or partially closed, affecting millions of students.
Teachers, like the tens of thousands of others across the country, are here today to make sure their voices are heard. They're part of a wave of industrial action across the different sectors of the economy, all calling on the government for pay rises that match the soaring inflation.
Teachers' unions are also hitting out at leaked text messages between disgraced former Health Minister Matt Hancock and former Education Minister Gavin Williamson, in which the latter describes teachers as skivers. That, in addition to a leaked report last year that hundreds of schools in England were dilapidated and at risk of collapsing. Despite that and a massive strike last month, the government has refused to budge.
We've actually given teachers the highest pay rise in 30 years. It includes a 9% pay rise for newly qualified teachers and record investment in their training and development.
To the National Education Union, who accused the government of refusing meaningful talks, that is simply not true.
We were offered 5% for teachers at some points on the scale, less than that for others. And because we've had a pay freeze for loads of successive years since 2010, and then a few pay awards that were either below or in line with inflation, that's effectively another pay cut.
The next strike is planned for March 15. If there's no movement on pay, we're likely to see more strikes, not just from the teachers like Sapna, but workers in other key professions, who at least for now, enjoy broad public support. Saeed Puriza, London.
Now, the United States and South Korea will hold large-scale military drills later this month, despite a stern warning from North Korea. South Korea's military says the exercises will focus on countering threats from Pyongyang.
이번 연합 연습은
The joint exercise is designed to strengthen response capabilities of the alliance by focusing within the exercise scenario on the changing threats and security environment, such as North Korea's advanced nuclear and missile program and lessons learned from recent wars and conflicts.
The drills dubbed the Freedom Shield include amphibious landings. The 10-day maneuvers will kick off on March 13. They feature field exercises on a scale not seen in years. Last month, North Korea cautioned that it would take an unprecedented action if the two allies go ahead with their drills. Pyongyang has repeatedly rebuked Seoul and Washington for their frequent muscle flexing around the Korean Peninsula. It says the two countries' joint drills are actually rehearsals for an invasion. North Korea usually responds to such drills by carrying out missile tests. And in South Korea, the families of the victims of the Seoul Halloween disaster have marched through the streets of the capital city. They are pressing ahead with their demand for a sincere apology and the assumption of responsibility by senior officials. Nearly 160 people lost their lives in the crowd crush. Frank Smith has this report from Seoul.
At Seoul City Hall, the families of the victims of the Itaewon tragedy and their supporters gathered to pay their respects at a temporary memorial and to press the government to apologize and punish those ultimately responsible. Kim Hae-in's brother, Woo Hyun, was among the 159 people killed in the crowd crush last Halloween.
They didn't do anything before to prevent the disaster, and they're still not doing anything. That's why we're out here. The higher-ups who should take responsibility and prevent this from happening are just shifting the blame to others.
Two separate probes, one by the police and another by lawmakers at the National Assembly, resulted in the indictment of several lower-level police and local officials. The aftermath of the Itaewon tragedy quickly turned political. The conservative Minister of Interior and Safety, Lee Sang-min, initially suggested the disaster could not have been prevented, angering families of the victims. The democratically controlled National Assembly voted to impeach Lee last month. Officials knew tens of thousands of young people would gather in Itaewon that night, yet no crowd control measures were taken. Beginning at 6:34 p.m., hours before the crowd crush, more than 10 emergency calls warned the police of overcrowding.
Holding the people accountable and getting them to resign can offer the families some consolation and honor the victims. But the government is not now taking those steps, as if the government is not responsible for anything. It's shameful.
Of those that died, 26 were foreigners, including 5 Iranian exchange students. As families of the victims and their supporters marched to the presidential office, they again called for truth and justice and a proper memorial to their lost loved ones. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Turning to the United States now, where over 40 million people have just seen a major reduction in their federal assistance in buying food. Experts on food insecurity warned that the country is about to fall off what they are calling a hunger cliff. Rami Mazahari has more on this story from Chicago.
Even though inflation remains at a 40-year high, United States President Joe Biden has terminated a program which provided extra food money for over 40 million of the poorest Americans. The elderly, the disabled, students, poor children, and the working poor are now forced to find an average of nearly $100 more every month to spend on food. With sanctions on Russia still massively backfiring across the West, grocery prices here have soared more than 11% over the last year.
The families aren't purchasing food at the same price that they were pre-pandemic. So apart from having families come in more often, we may start seeing families that have to cut back on their housing budget. So what they typically spent on rent, utilities, they may have to start dipping into that to pay for groceries.
Experts on food insecurity contend that food aid to the poor has been insufficient, and that was long before the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program started seeing cuts. The expansion of so-called food stamps was both popular and successful, leading to an immediate 10% reduction in the overall poverty rate and a 14% drop in child poverty.
Versus 2021, when a lot of the pandemic relief was in force, our numbers were actually down significantly. So we've seen our numbers grow from 2021 to 2022 about 40%. Give or take. We can only imagine what this next round will bring.
Without government involvement, citizens can only turn to charities for help. In states which have prematurely stopped the expanded food aid, food banks are already reporting a 40% increase in the number of visitors. Last year, the ruling Democrats voted to end the pandemic's expansion of Medicaid, the federal program which provides a bare minimum of health care for the nation's poor. At the end of this month, at least 15 million people will also lose their health care coverage. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
That brings an end to International Bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
History of Knowledge in Iran. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Most historians believe that the great bulk of progresses in human sciences and civilization is indebted to the Iranian scientists and civilization. As it was said in the previous episode of this series, UNESCO had dubbed last year as the International Year of Basic Sciences for Sustainable Development, that is IYBSSD 2022, to mark the importance and role of sciences in human life. Please stay with us for the second part of this series. Perhaps you have noticed that some powers, regimes, and governments make serious effort to divide nations and ethnicities into civilized and uncivilized ones. They try to change history and even names of places, events, and persons so that the nationality of a scientist or a scholar is not recognized easily. At times, these powers and regimes totally deny the move and endeavor of a nation or people toward progress and growth. Such unfair efforts began in 17th and 18th centuries and continue to date. If we consider knowledge as conscious dealing with nature, we will accept that mankind has always lived with knowledge. In other words, the man who lived nearly 100,000 years ago used to try hard for better life. Current sciences, including math, are the result of the whole mankind all over the planet. Different peoples in different ages were in different levels of civilization and, relying on their intellect and experiences, intended to discover the laws of nature to have a better life. Basic mathematical concepts like quantity and shape have always been with man, and generally speaking, math has had a life as long as man. Math, however, didn't mean the science of numbers in the ancient worlds, but it was quite tangible in buildings, water structures, tools, and equipment. For instance, the rules of math can clearly be seen in the construction of Achaemenid palaces, mapping and making of the means of transportation, such as ships and chariots. Some of the mathematical principles and rules, such as algebra tables and equations, were quite common in the ancient Shush or Susa in southwestern Iran. The devising of measurement units by Iranian mathematicians spread these concepts to vast areas of those days. The remnants of that era indicate that Iranians were notably aware of geometry. Many Greek scientists benefited from Iranians in this field. Pythagoras, as a founder of geometry, registered Pythagoras' theorem in his name after his journey to the East and benefiting from the Iranian scientists. This is while historical documents bear witness that the geometricians of Shush knew the theorem well, but they had failed to present it publicly. In the 7th and 6th centuries BC, the Iranian culture was transferred to Babylon and North Africa. Iran's cultural contact with Greece was quite common during the 5th and 6th centuries BC. And although Alexander of Macedonia assaulted Iran and devastated many cities and ancient monuments, Iranian culture spread to Greece and the adjoining regions. during the Parthian rule, some of the savants of Sistan, that is eastern Iran, went to India and founded mathematical and astronomical traditions over there. They were known as Magus Brahman. The noted Iranian mathematician Brahma Gupta had apparently remained from those people. Iranians were the founders of algebra and trigonometry. The concept of number was formed in Iran as a variable quantity. Dynamic equations were broadly pursued to put the foundations of non-Euclidean geometry. This was the basic for Western Europe to follow up the endeavor. If we'll have a look at the theoretical aspect of math, we can divide it into four eras, including era of formation of awareness and mathematical concepts. Number two, era of elementary math. Number three, era of math with variable quantities. And number four, era of modern math. Iran passed through the first era till the 7th century AD and stepped in the second era of progress from the end of the 8th century till early 9th century and entered even the third era in some domains. Of course, with regards to the remaining documents and also archaeological discoveries, this category can change a little. During the first era of math, the concepts of this science were in close relation with people's daily needs. Counting of livestock, division of agricultural lands, establishment of temples and palaces, building of bridges and dams, securing of provision for warriors, and so on. More advanced phases included calculations pertaining to trade, shipping, securing of water needed for agriculture, and digging of kanats, or underground water canals. Naturally, with the start of city dwelling and emergence of powerful states, mathematical methods for solving of problems developed alongside increase of needs. Math was at the service of man in this era. The era of elementary math was the time when concepts and rules became abstract while keeping their relation with the scientific and social needs. The Elamites ruled from 4th century BC in the south and southwest of Iran. Powerful Elamite states ruled vast regions from their capital. They had common borders with Sumerians and then Babylonians and enjoyed the system of slavery like those two neighbors. The close relation of Sumerians with Elamites included broad cultural and commercial dealings and continuous wars and skirmishes. Thus, in some spheres, it is very hard to separate cultural progresses of these two nations. Elamites left such a rich culture through 35 centuries, whose impact has remained in all eras of the Iranian civilization. Although little has remained of the Elamite civilization, the Elamite language and writing was used during the next eras, such as the Pars. Math in Shush, like in the neighboring countries in Mesopotamia, was in close relation with people's routine needs. Few mathematical texts that have been found from Shush show that mathematicians of the region were mainly priests and soothsayers who had got access to a kind of numeric system and even many abstract deductions of elementary math. Elamite mathematicians were well acquainted with mathematical rules of triangles and polygons. Although there is little documentary made on progresses in math during 1,200 years, spanning the 6th century BC till 7th century AD, it is obvious from the architecture and artistic works of the era that engineering had remarkably advanced. Astronomy and music, as two sciences closely related with math, climaxed in this era.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdy. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Another missile test by North Korea. Four long-range cruise missiles were fired. A repeated scenario in response to U.S. joint war games. But is this time different? North Korea says it is, and the U.S. and its regional allies believe these missiles are being developed with the intent to arm them with nuclear warheads. In this edition of the program, we will look at why the U.S. is ramping up military pressure instead of diplomatic overtures on Pyongyang, and why it is content in doing that knowing that North Korean missiles are capable of reaching the U.S. mainland. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. William Jones from the Executive Intelligence Review joins us from Leesburg. Jim Cavan, a political analyst and blogger, joins us from New York. To welcome you both, and William Jones, let me first start with you. First, get your reaction on the missiles that were fired. We're looking at four long-range cruise missiles. The question is whether this time is different based on how the capabilities, as it was reported, it said these were strategic cruise missiles designed to demonstrate its ability to conduct a nuclear counterattack. The key word being counterattack here, I think. So do you deem this to be different than the previous missile launches?
Well, they're obviously improving their capabilities here. Reports have it that some of the missiles had made a oval and even a double-eight maneuver, showing that there is greater maneuverability in these missiles. And, of course, they're reaching now to almost 2,000 kilometers. It's really a serious upgrade on the part of North Korea. And as the situation becomes more tense, directly after the maneuvers between Japan, South Korea, and the U.S., where the U.S. is doing significant upgrading in the Asia-Pacific region generally, aimed at North Korea, but also against China. This has created a great deal of tension where the North Koreans typically react by trying to show some of their capabilities. So I think there is an increased tension, there's increased capability that North Korea is now showing. But I think they're doing it in a context in which the tensions are being fed by U.S. policy in the region, which is increasingly more pushing the military rather than diplomatic solution to the problem, especially the problems with the DPRK.
So you're seeing a relationship there between the U.S. militaristic approach towards the region and the number of missiles or the times the missiles are being launched by North Korea?
Well, sure. They are trying to utilize the maximum capability that they actually have there. I think this probably would not have occurred had the maneuvers not taken place. And the maneuvers, of course, are directly aimed at North Korea and have been criticized by North Korea prior to their being held in the area, so that it was a direct affront, I think they felt, to their attempt to maintain some kind of stability in the region. And they're reacting in the way that DPR always react.
Jim Cavanaugh, taking a look at the joint war games was reported on this between the U.S. and South Korea, what was different about this is the fact that it was held in Washington, they called it a tabletop exercise, which focused on, I guess, hypothetical scenarios of which North Korea would use nuclear weapons. And this was the first of its sort under the South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol. Is that what is that indicative of, or what does that show, that it was practiced in the U.S.?
I'm not sure that shows very much. The United States and South Korea have engaged in real military exercises, and that's what really annoys the North Koreans. It was a tabletop exercise in Washington. Of course, it's presented as a defensive exercise, but of course, even in the middle of a defensive exercise, they're going to plan for an invasion of North Korea, and North Korea knows that. So it's just a fact of the military cooperation and the tight military cooperation between South Korea and the United States going to Washington to do these exercises that has North Korea on edge. Look, everybody has to understand the history of the Korean War, which is kind of a forgotten war. That was a vicious war. The United States bombed North Korea to rubble, and they did that to prevent the unification of the peninsula under the forces that had fought the Japanese, which was a vicious Japanese occupation. And they did that in support of a dictatorial regime in the south, which was composed of people who had collaborated with the Japanese. So the North Koreans have a history. They know, they have a historical memory of what it means for the United States to attack them. And that's why they're on edge all the time about this. So, you know, they're never going to stop being on edge about South Korean, United States military exercises and military cooperation and building up forces. And now the United States is building up Japan again to be, Joe Biden vowed to make Japan a potent military force. You know, again, the Japanese occupation of Korea was vicious. So the North Koreans have a historical memory that most people in the West, you know, the Korean War was glossed over in our history, and not for them. So they remember this, and they're going to be on edge about any American military exercises in the region. And they know what's going on with China and Taiwan. They know that even NATO has said, we've got to extend our reach into the Pacific. For some reason, the Pacific's part of the North Atlantic now. So there's a world situation, and in that area too, which is on the edge of conflict. Sure. And the Americans seem to be ready for conflict everywhere, and the North Koreans are aware of that.
There's a number of points that you raised there. Before we get to those points, however, I got to find out whether we can zoom in, William Jones, on who goes first. Trying to figure this out based on the way things are being reported. I mentioned what's happening in the States with this tabletop exercises, but this is an exercise held where the U.S. has announced that this is being done because of a potential nuclear strike by North Korea. Okay? They're looking at it that way. But the North's posturing is one of counterattack, meaning the U.S. or its allies would attack first. Is that accurate reading it that way? And then there's this the fact that this does not read with how each stands in terms of attacking first, because each thinks the other is going to attack first.
Well, I think that's probably they would be wary of trying to start a nuclear conflict with the United States of their own volition. Since they realize there's going to be perhaps a destruction of the nation. But they must have that capability. The reason they're going with a nuclear, becoming a nuclear power, effectively becoming a nuclear power, is that they feel that there's no other option open to them, that the opposition of the United States to the DPRK has been pretty straightforward through the years. The only exception was when President Trump successfully conducted negotiations with North Korea. People felt that it could be resolved diplomatically. But he was heavily criticized by the military-industrial complex while he was still president, while this was still ongoing. And then afterwards, of course, has been totally rejected by the Biden administration, which feels that only a policy of showing force, peace through strength, can make any headway with regard to the DPR. And of course, that causes the major conflict, so that they see these as the nuclear capability that they have as a capability of being able to fend off and to respond to a possible nuclear attack from the West. But they do it by showing what they can do, because words are not going to convince anybody in the U.S. military-industrial complex that North Korea is not a threat, unless it shows that it is. And this is why they're very demonstrative in showing the weapons, rather than pursuing an aggressive policy. They want to show that we can respond, and you should do this with some respect, and you should try and come to some kind of a negotiated position with us. But at this point, it just has not succeeded because of the tremendous opposition to the United States of diplomacy in the DPRK-U.S. relationship.
So your guess, yes or no answer, if I may ask you that, William Jones, based on how you see it, if the situation continues this way, who would strike first?
Well, I do not think that the DPRK would make any first strike unless they were significantly threatened, or they felt that they were significantly threatened.
Well, they're feeling that right now, right?
Well, that's a real question. What is the red line here? I mean,
I tell you why they're feeling that. Let me throw this stat out there. You have all the different missile tests that have happened. I'm going to address Jim Kavanaugh with this. Jim Kavanaugh, you have all these missile tests that North Korea has executed throughout the years, and then boom, 2020. I'm sorry, I shouldn't say that. I shouldn't use that word. Then you have the year 2022, and you have 72 of them. You had 22 missile tests in a span of 3 days. I think they're feeling threatened, or they're trying to say something. What do you think? What do you make of that? And this happening during the tenure of the current U.S. President Joe Biden?
Well, I think they are trying to demonstrate that if we get hit, we can impose serious damage on those who come after us. Look, they have certain problems with this. They did demonstrate some maneuvering capabilities with these cruise missiles, but they're still saying they're not yet capable of carrying nuclear weapons. The nuclear weapons, ballistic missiles they have are still liquid fuel missiles, which means they cannot be readied very quickly. The United States knows what's happening there. If North Korea were to start fueling up their ICBMs for an attack on someone, the United States would know it.
Can they? I
think so, probably, because they're liquid-fueled missiles. They require preparation.
They can't be easily moved around. Why not push for some kind of diplomatic move, something, a concession maybe of some kind? I'm guessing when you have missiles that can reach the U.S. mainland, and you say that maybe it could be capable of nuclear warhead, which the reading was by the U.S., that this is a rehearsal for developing nuclear warheads or putting nuclear warheads on it, you would guess there'd be some kind of diplomatic overture. Why isn't there one?
Well, I don't think, is the American administration ready to have a diplomatic overture with North Korea? Because it doesn't want to, they could put in, the Korean War is still going on. There's no peace treaty.
William Jones, what do you think?
The United States doesn't want to put an end to it.
Let me get William Jones an answer on this. I'm sorry, Jim Kavanaugh. William Jones, why not?
Nobody can say for sure what the North Korean leadership's decisions will be in this. There's a lot of erratic movement. There's a lot of irrationalism. However, I think it's quite clear to them that if they would launch a strike against the United States, or even a strike against the United States facilities like in Guam, or perhaps even a strike against Japan, there would probably be an overwhelming reaction by U.S. nuclear forces, which would essentially end the North Korean state entirely. I think there's a certain understanding of that. And therefore, I think that they would be very reticent in starting that fight. But at the same time, they want to have the capability for a variety of reasons, for defense reasons, but also in terms of the political influence that being a nuclear power has in the world, which they also want to attain. But I think short of that, I think that if they launched an attack, it would be like a hand grenade that would be set off in North Korea itself, ending the North Korean state. Mm-hmm. I don't think the North Korean leadership, as mercurial as they are, is totally insane on this issue.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right. Well, you both have mentioned Japan on a couple of occasions now, so let's look at the military defense budget. It has been raised by 26%. That's the largest. What does that mean when it comes to what Jim Kavanaugh, what you said? You said that the U.S. is going to be pumping them up with arms. First of all, does Japan want to really get in on this with the U.S.? Is Japan acting on its own free will when it comes to the way that it stands with North Korea?
Well, I think there are political factions in Japan that want to rearm, that would like Japan to become a potent military force, quote unquote, in the region again. And they are, in de facto, the United States is promoting that and doing that, and they will do it. Now, it's not just in relation to Korea, but it's in relation to the region as a whole. And, you know, again, it is very, the peculiarity of the North Korean situation is unique. And again, the Japan's relationship with Korea is terrible. And historically, you know, I don't think they're looking to reinvade and reoccupy Korea, but they are part of the American hegemonic domination of the Pacific region. And that's what they've thrown in their lot, like Europe has thrown in its lot, Western Europe and Eastern Europe with the United States and Europe. Japanese have thrown in their lot with the Americans, and we are going to be part of your hegemonic program in the Pacific region, which means we're going to support whatever you do in China and whatever you do in North Korea.
Okay, since you mentioned China, need to ask you about that, Bill Jones. What is the relationship between China and North Korea?
The relationship is still a friendly relationship. I don't think they have control over what North Koreans do. They have some influence. But I think they're also very wary and uncertain about where that's going. They would like to have a diplomatic resolution to the nuclear issue. They do want a nuclear-free Korean peninsula. They would like to see this moving forward, but they are not the chief players there. And as long as there is no indication from the United States to achieve such a solution, they have very little they can do. The issue of North Korea, of course, is also, in one sense, defensive for them, because the fact that the North Koreans are there as a former ally and still a very good friend, a lot of trade relations between the two, this is also preserves a buffer in many respects against Japan in particular, which is becoming more hostile, at least in the defense area. And even South Korea, which still maintains very good relationships with China, but is also being wooed by the United States to join in some kind of alliance, perhaps of a military character, aimed against China. So the China's position is that they would like to see a stable DPRK. They would like to see some kind of diplomatic solution to this. They would use their influence, mm-hmm. I believe, if the United States were willing to move in that direction. But they do not want a military conflict on the Korean Peninsula, okay, because this would be very disastrous.
Jim Kavanaugh, I asked you about the number of missile launches that North Korea did in the year 2022, which was the most, 70, compared to the previous years. Now, there's one theory that says North Korea has upped its number of missile exercises because it's also wanting to send a message, but not of the direct kind, to the U.S., because it shows that what the U.S. intentions in the region are, aside from doing something about North Korea, is to target China. So with these exercises increasing to the point that it has, this may make the U.S. think twice about a military engagement in the region. Do you think that's the type of message that North Korea has sent to the U.S.? Does the U.S. see it that way?
Well, I'm sure the U.S. does see it that way, in the sense that the U.S. would like to know that there's no side action here that's going to come from North Korea if they get into a conflict with China, which very well might happen. And by the fact of doing all this testing, and I think the main reason North Korea is doing all the testing is because it's doing a lot of development of new weapon systems, and it wants to make sure they work, and it wants to demonstrate to the world that they work. But the side effect of that is that it puts the United States in a position of having to think twice about. That's why the United States would like to get rid of this North Korean issue before they take on China in any way. I'm sure they'd like to do that, like they want to get rid of Syria and Iran, you know, Syria and Libya before they take on Iran. So there's a lot of things going on in that respect. But, you know, the main reason the North Koreans are doing it, I think, is because they want to develop their systems, and they need to develop their systems, which aren't completely developed. And the United States does need to worry, at least, you know, what we have to take account if we're going to have military action with China. Will the North Koreans come in, and will their missiles be part of the package that we have to deal with in such a conflict?
All right. A final question. Unfortunately, I have so many, but final question, Bill Jones, goes to you. This is an odd request, to say the least, when the U.S. holds China responsible for North Korea's multiple missile launches. It's even asked China and Russia to pressure North Korea to stop. I mean, really? Do you think that the U.S. even... Well, I mean, hey, you got to give it to the U.S. You know, they're asking what they cite as a number one and two national security threats to please do us a favor and stop North Korea from launching these missiles. How do you view that U.S. request from both China and Russia? In under a minute, please.
Well, why would they help the United States in any sense in this issue, when Russia, of course, is under attack by the United States, and where China has been a target of hostility from the U.S., in which the Taiwan issue is now being played with? It's not a situation in which you have a whole lot of trust between these countries. Okay. In other circumstances, perhaps there would be cooperation if you were working towards like a security architecture in the Asia Pacific. They would work together. But to the extent that the U.S. has named Russia an enemy and also China as an enemy, you're not going to get too many favors out of them.
Indeed. Thank you very much for that. William Jones, Executive Intelligence Review from Leesburg. Jim Kavanaugh, political analyst and blogger from New York. Thank you. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tahwei and the team, it's goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Satorbat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Muhammad is my guide, Muhammad is my teacher, Muhammad my beloved Rasulullah.
I want to be like you.
Like you.
In everything I do, Ya Rasulullah.
I want to walk like you, talk like you, read my Quran just like you. Rasulullah.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to this program, Like Muhammad from IRIB English Radio. This is Rajabian. I am a seminary student doing my Kharij studies, and I am doing my PhD on Islamic studies. Inshallah, in this program, we will talk about the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam. One of the important things that matters and is important for all of us is the issue of tongue and speaking. It is this small part of the body that, you know, it is maybe, I don't know how much is its or how much is its weight, but we see that how important it is that it can change the story of life of a person, can change the story of life of a community and a nation. So it is of such an importance, an important thing that I think we all have experienced such a thing that maybe one word changes our relations with others or deteriorate, you know, the relations or make it stronger, things like that. So we see practically we can understand the place of speaking and tongue. Well, it's a great and maybe the main means of communication nowadays. You can see that in the story of Prophet Musa, when he was sent, Prophet Moses, when he was sent to Pharaoh to preach him and talk with him about religion, about God, unity of God, and these issues, and he, accompanied with his brother Aaron, they were going to go to Pharaoh. He asked God, said that Rabbi shrahli sadri wa yassir li amri wa hlul uqdatan min lisani yafqahu qawli. Oh God, please, open the ties of my tongue and make my words understandable. So this is the place of tongue, even in religious issues and, you know, in communicating the religious messages by the prophets of God. So we see that in a lot of Ahadith, in the Holy Quran, there are a lot of things referring to tongue, referring to its, limitations, the red lines that we have for our tongue and our speaking. So, for example, being talkative or silent, which one is better? What are the rewards? What are the good actions, acts of worship that can be done by tongue? You see, in the prayers, when you are offering your prayers, your daily prayers, well, what is that part of body that you are using more? The most used one is this little part, the tongue. Well, you should recite the Holy Quran in your prayer. You should recite the provocations, the adhkar. So you can make a lot of rewards by this small part and member of the body. The same thing is in the other hand. Well, there are a lot of sins